Hello, Miss Handy. Welcome to Iandom.
Are you talking to me, Bob?
I think so. Yes, hi. Talking to you.
Hi, I've been listening for a while.
Good.
Like since, I think, noon. So I heard all the Hillary stuff.
Yeah.
And it is interesting because it's like the last time I talked to her, I think, was 3 weeks ago, and that's when I was being pouty and declared that I was never going to look at the stuff.
You mean you? You mean you know Hillary?
No. I listened to her. I thought she was great. I listened to you two on the phone.
Yes.
I'm just saying that it's interesting because 3 weeks ago I was exactly where she was with this material. Like, I'm so new to it.
Yeah.
But since I had looked at it, and I'm no expert, but I did read some stuff, and I can tell you what I looked at. It was interesting for me to hear you talk to her and say things to her that was fresh in my mind from having looked at McLuhan stuff. Yeah, and so I was kind of, it was like you were talking to me, too, and I could see where you were trying to take her.
Right.
And so that was really interesting.
Yeah, I just said it's very appropriate that you're the next person after her because you read some of the Gutenberg Galaxy or something, right?
I did. I looked at a bunch of different stuff. And is Madeline still around? Is she on the line?
Yeah, they're all here. I put them on mute because it's your hour, but if you request someone to come in, we'll bring them in.
Well, I would love Madeline to come in if she wants to because she's really the first one who, when I was having my snit with Kathy Scholl, pulled out of the conversation, look at this, Katie. You've declared that you're not going to look at any of Bob's stuff, the McLuhan stuff.
Oh, yeah, right.
And how's that working for you? And I was Kathy, and I responded to her like, you know, well, I can't remember what I said. And then after I calmed down, I realized that she was right. And then Carolyn had said something to me, too, about the Emerald Tablet. Like how I just didn't realize how much this context is really necessary in the whole thing.
See, look at the perfect symmetry. You're having Katie comes in after she hears herself from a month ago.
Right.
Three weeks ago. That's pretty good. So, yeah, Madeline can speak. You want to say something, Madeline?
Well, all I will say is that I have been looking forward to your section of this, Katie. I can't wait to hear what you have to talk about now that you've looked into some of this.
Well, will you stay with me on the phone?
Yes, it's scary. It's scary being up here with Bob in the McLuhan office.
Well, it's not really that, but it's like I'm a little bit embarrassed, and the Maui sessions, Maui sessions, I listened to Ginny's to prepare.
Yeah.
And she talks about a time when she started to look at this material and just realized that she was part of something that was, like, so much bigger.
Yeah.
And I had that experience. And then Michael was saying how it's so hard to know how to keep up with all the material. Like, when I looked through that McLuhan on Maui website, I was just like, oh, my God.
Yes.
Like, there's so much here.
That you had never seen before. You had never seen that kind of content.
Thought about, and it was so interesting. And then I realized that I kind of came to Ion through this door, even though I didn't really realize it until Ginny and I did the book review show, and we reviewed Michael Brown's Retrieval of Atom Man, and that really is more of a media ecology plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I loved it when I first read it. And then I remembered when I first talked to you, I had looked at the CDS YouTube of McLuhan talking and thought I kind of got it. But then it just seemed, I don't know if I got overwhelmed or I was afraid that I would, like, look really stupid. I mean, this stuff is so highbrow.
Yeah. Can you speak a little, put your mic closer to your mouth or speak a little louder? You seem faint.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, that's a slightly better, yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got my headset on.
Yeah, so just put the mic closer to your mouth or something.
Okay, now it's close to my mouth as it'll go. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't really know where to start with this.
Well, what can you explain? What is Hillary not getting about the effect of visual space in the book that you've read McLuhan on? Can you explain what Hillary doesn't get?
Well, I don't think that she gets how the media disturbs the ratio of your senses.
Yeah.
And changes us so much that even though she'd like to think that we could go back to that childlike mind,
that's ridiculous.
The media is just churning and churning and churning against that.
Yeah, the children themselves are not children anymore.
Right, right. And just how, you know, we're just so visual. And what that really means.
It doesn't mean colorful. Color is not visual. Color is tactile. Visual,
right,
as McClure means, that abstract page, alphabetic imaging in your mind.
Right.
You think in either voices or the alphabet in words. A lot of people have the black and white images from books are in their mind, and that's what they're thinking of. That's visual space. It's an abstract space.
Well, then I realized, too, because I didn't really understand what literacy was. And
yeah.
Ginny did a really good job of talking about that in her discussion with you, too, because she talked about it, how that becomes literal and linear, and so she explained all that. And then I remembered that I had forgotten. But when I lived in Arkansas a couple of years ago, I met two women who were illiterate, and I took that Laubach method to teach people how to learn to read. Do you know what I'm talking about, the each one teach one?
No, I don't know that.
Well, it's the Laubach method, Frank Laubach. He was a missionary. And this was in like 1884. He was also a Christian and a mystic. He was known as the apostle to the illiterate. And so he went to a remote location in the Philippines, and he developed the Eat One, Teach One literacy program.
Yeah.
And so he imposed an alphabet on an illiterate culture. And then
he imposed the phonetic alphabet or his own new alphabet.
He took the moral language and was able to develop an alphabet for that language and teach it to the people.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And then when I was in Arkansas and I met these illiterate women, I took his method and taught these women to read. And I had forgotten that I'd had that experience because it was neat, and then I moved and whatever. But, like, to have had the experience of using a mnemonic device to teach someone a letter and a sound and how it goes with that. Like, I realized now in looking at this material that I've actually had that experience. And I think that was kind of cool as I was looking
at it. Well, is the letter, are the letters that he uses non-pictorial, like A, B, C, D, E?
No, they are pictorial. So if you're going to teach someone, and I don't remember how it goes because it's been a couple of years, but like if you're going to teach someone the letter B, there might be a picture of a bird, and then you can see the letter B that's drawn in the bird. So its fat little body would
right.
be the fall of the B, and the tail would be the, and then you say a mnemonic device, so you say, here is a B, and it comes right down with the tail, and it goes around. And so you're teaching somebody through almost like a song. You know how it's easier to remember things?
Yeah, you're not teaching the phonetic effect. And I was going to make sure to tell you this. The key point.
Tell me this.
Yeah, the key point in the Gutenberg galaxy, the unique point, is that the phonetic alphabet that the Greeks developed from the Phoenicians, and maybe the Hebrews had some impact in there, is you got A, B, C, D, E. They do not look like anything. All writing in ideogrammic cultures, and they would have the ideogrammic culture of thousands of letters, thousands of pictures for everything, because everything's unique. But when you got Alexander the Great gets 26 letters, they are streamlined, a semi-line that absorbs all the nuances of writing systems that have pictures
mm-hmm.
and are individual. So to have a sound, A, B, C, D, E, there's no context for those letters
mm-hmm.
other than the alphabet themselves. So we're talking about the first mental thing. You've got to take abstract letters with abstract sounds that have no natural evocative thing of onomatopoeia going on. So you create this abstract structure, and you've made yourself abstract, internal, mental imagery,
mm-hmm.
which has no reference point, doesn't look like anything, these letters, and then it's able to absorb all pictorial cultures all around the Middle East. So Alexander the Great went around, and he could take all the different oral semi-writing cultures and make them standardized, fit into the 26 letters, and that homogenization was a traumatic thing. And that's how he could set up a bureaucracy and dominate all the diversities that each oral culture is.
What would the trauma have been like to a person at that time when that was happening?
Well, there'd be the elites would be using it, the generals, the soldiers. The majority of people had not, they did not get affected by the alphabet. And then Greece collapsed, but then Rome came along and added chariots and roads and spread the paper over a wider space. And then they're doing that for like 400 years. That's a slow inculcation of, you know, inculcation of the alphabetic abstract effect continuously. So it affects the other levels of the elite. Does not affect the people. The average citizen doesn't really get affected by the printing press till like the 1800s, right?
Okay.
So the people are always oral and pagan and running around, and that's why the Catholic Church doesn't have any doctrine. They just came, the peasants just came and watched the ritual performed, the Mass, right? There was no semantic reading of the content of the Bible. They were doing it as an oral culture. So the Catholics are more oral than the Protestants. Protestantism gets built on the printing press. But back to, this is the point. When you understand the abstract effect of the phonetic alphabet, then you understand the difference McLuhan is saying that the phonetic alphabet is to separate it from all the other cultures, and that creates the unique abstract mind-body split of Western man, European man, the Eurocentric man. And the printing press makes it go all around the world and gives the Western man, European man, the ability to dominate all these innocent oral cultures. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand, he would say, semantically meaningless, A, B, C, D, E, or you go, abacada, meaningless, no pictorial, they're not showing a tree. What does A represent? Can you spell A? How do you spell the letter A? So it's this abstract, weird thing visually, and it has a weird, abstract sound. That is very anti, or the interaction of speaking and gesture that normal bodies have. So you got this abstract mind with this abstract space, and then that's where the geometry, Euclidean geometry, the Greek geometry comes in, where they start making relations among this abstract visual space. And no other culture did that.
Mm-hmm.
So the West is this odd freak on the elite manager level, not on the peasant level, for 1,500 years. And then the printing press comes, which is the first assembly line, and now the peasant can read and experience the alphabet effect by themselves. And that's the beginning of the population in Europe becoming literate and a mass level of abstraction in their minds. It's kind of a schizophrenic. When you read the book, you must translate these abstract letters into the semantic meanings they represent. So you make this sub-vocalization in your mind. You translate it. And the more faster reader you are doing it faster and don't notice it. But just go, watch how a little kid learns the alphabet. And then they walk around with that wound, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
They are now trying to find semantic meaning from these letters, and they don't have any reference point. So that's the point. You may not get it all right now, but that is the thing to keep trying to get an understanding of.
Okay. I feel like I go in and out of it. Like sometimes
yes.
I feel like and then I'm like, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed, I don't get it at all.
Well, you're oscillating back and forth with your other senses. People, if you start talking to McLuhan, you'll say, well, the literacy came in. They'll go, well, Japan had writing, Korea had writing, China had writing, and then you say,
but
no, they did not.
Characters.
Yes, they had characters. And then you have to be able to explain the uniqueness of the phonetic alphabet. And if you can get that across, then they realize, oh, yeah, that has a different effect than all the pictorial syllabaries have.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, okay, but that's okay. That's just local to management in Europe. No big deal. McLuhan would say the medieval culture was actually balanced. It had a bit of abstract eye with the manuscript and a bit of acoustic space. But when you took the printing press and could spread that over whole societies and everybody experiencing the flat visual space of the abstract page, that is a devastating meme, a devastating sensory ratio upset.
And that's when the ear becomes the eye.
That's right. And that's when patriarchy really took off. And you can read the, now you should read The Alphabet and the Goddess, this popularization
really?
Of, yes, the popularization
okay.
of McLuhan by this L.A. surgeon. He's dead now, but he did a pretty good job of explaining what I'm saying to you within the feminist world and the patriarchal world. Patriarchal's alphabet versus the goddess, which is the non-alphabet. So it's very good. It's another way to get this. What?
Leonard Schlain.
Yes. So have you looked at the book, Madeline?
Well, I just looked it up when Carolyn mentioned it earlier. It looks pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah, it's right up here, guys. You know, it's a surgeon dealing with... See, McLuhan was before feminism. This is after feminism. And this surgeon, you know, had to work with nurses and all that. And he's propagating. He's taking, in a way, he doesn't fully get it, but he's saying right hemisphered feminism or women will take over because they can handle the post-left hemisphere, post-literate world more than men. So he's an apologist for women against the men. But back mm-hmm. to this, but at least he talks about it in media terms, in the phonetic alphabet. And he cites Robert Logan, which is the book on the history of the alphabet, and the details are spelled out in that book, which was written with McLuhan in the 70s, but Logan didn't get it published. McLuhan actually didn't like the way it was written. But 7 years later, after McLuhan died, Logan managed to get it published. And it's a good history of all these writing points, you know, mm-hmm. technically. So back to this point. So the printing press spreads visual space around the planet, and that creates solid, imperialistic, colonialistic patriarchy. The images we have from like 1700 up to 1900, society, that's an aberration, those 300 years. Societies were not like so fragmented and have these guys running the show and the women fucking doing nothing or just being a subservient slave, right? That is an odd phenomenon for 300 years. And the electric age turns the whole world into a workforce, so the women had to go to work, and so they got out of their specialist housewife role. That changed the world.
What year did that start? What year did that start?
Oh, by 67 to 70.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm thinking even before that, like when was electricity? Wasn't that in the 20s?
Now, that's 1850s. It does begin. You have the suffragettes. You know, in 1900, mm-hmm. 1910, 1920s, they're getting all worked up, and they want to become mm-hmm. men and have the right to mm-hmm. vote. And then the women actually have to work in factories during World War II. So that is a change. But then as soon as the war was over, they went back to suburbia, right?
Well,
they went
the
back
other
to
thing that I think, the other thing that I think, too, I love Downton Abbey. And I was thinking as I was reading that, that I think was the 20s. And they were just starting to get electricity. And they were still all in manuscript culture because they had those notes and the sealing wax and the letters and the rumors and like that.
Move your mic back down. You're gone faint again.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
A little better. Just maybe speak a little louder and get that mic. Are you got your mic muffled?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I wonder if I should pick up my headset. I mean, pick up my handset. I've got a like a mic on my phone at work. I'll just try and speak louder and more clearly.
Well, pick up your headset. Try that.
I don't know if I can. Maybe I should call back on my cell phone. Like, I have to unplug this. Well, let me just see something. Hang on one second.
Stay on the line and try your phone.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Much better.
Okay, I'll hold this to my ear. I have no problem doing that. Let me see here. Hang on.
So Downton Abbey is trying to show a little bit the old lady sees the phonograph and thinks it's a monster and she has no clue of what's happening around her. You know, Maggie Smith.
Yeah. You blipped in and out to me now. You have to repeat that. I'm sorry.
Oh, I said in Downton Abbey, he tries to show the technology as figures. Like, the phonograph comes in, and Maggie Smith thinks that's weird, and she doesn't understand the radio. Like, she is showing the crusty old oral society. She's a semi-literate oral person running the oral medieval aristocracy. And her daughters, no, the granddaughters, are all being fragmented by literacy. It's the beginning of, well, they can take their own identity. They don't have to be a housewife or something. So you got the three daughters, all weird. You know what I mean? It's interesting. One becomes politically activist for literate values and marries the working guy. The other one, the loser one, eventually becomes a writer, which is a very abstract, non-feminine fucking activity. And she's so non-feminine that she's totally fit to be the writer, to be the male.
And then, and then falls in love because of it.
Yeah, and then you have the middle one, the pretty one. She's in between, and yet she's still more oral and aristocratic. You know what I mean? She's not going for. She doesn't need the literacy prop. She's healthy. You know what I mean? She's balanced, and so she's right in between. So the whole spectrum is right there.
And then they're getting light and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know, it made me think of something in this work made me think of that. And I think that might be why Downton Abbey is so popular, because
it's a replay of what happened to the baby boomers in the 60s.
Well, and then they're all moving toward jobs too, because everybody downstairs wants to go out and be a secretary or somehow get out.
Right.
And
so did you say it's all about light? Did you say the word light or white?
Yeah, because they're getting electricity at that time.
Yeah, that's
still
right.
They're using candles, but they're getting some electricity.
Now, look at here. In the 50s, TV is a hidden ground. The real effect is radio. So they do the tribal effect of radio and have World War II. Then they retreat, and the men take over the 50s. And you see a lot of this in the show Masters of Sex. That's pretty good for this dilemma in the 50s. But by the 60s, when the market has people, women buying cars and having transistor radios, there's too much fragmentation that the holding together of the last stage of the patriarchy of the 30s, 40s doesn't hold anymore. And the women are suddenly free. And on top of that, you also got the pill, and you've got the divorce, and the men want to run around because they got all these, what McLuhan called jujube girls to eat. And so that leaves a massive identity crisis. And by the end of the 60s, the tribe of women says, we are being destroyed. And so the chemical body women form feminism as a tribal response to going discarnate electrified bodies.
Well, and I don't know if this plays into this specific thing, but another talk that I listened to prepare for today was when you were talking to Sue, because I thought that would be really interesting. And you were talking about the airline.
Yes, Sue,
okay.
Yes.
So is that what you're talking, was that at this time too? Because that's another thing. Like, I didn't think of flight as a media.
Yeah, that's right.
It's really important to get when you look at this work is that the wheel is an extension of the foot, clothing of the skin. Like, anything that we use is going to massage us. Technology is not just things at Best Buy.
Yeah, it's not TV and entertainment media. You know, it is all inventions, from bulldozers to forks to underwear.
Right. Well, and then the other thing, too, is that when you have an imbalanced ratio, there's a numbing to compensate.
Yes. Katie, the numbing is actually the discovery McLuhan made. Nobody gets it. I was telling this to some McLuhanites the other day. They all think he said, oh, it's a global village and the medium is message. No, he says in Understand Media, I have figured out why societies don't recognize the media changing them. That's what he said, there's a numbness that happens. This was his big fucking discovery.
Well, I got that, Bob.
Yeah,
ha-ha.
That's good. Very ha ha
ha ha. Hey, let me
that's
tell you one
good.
More thing. This is totally off the subject, but I wanted to tell you. You know your little pornographic PR statement that you made about how you're going to fuck everything that moves for 5 days and well, you posted that on a thread that was on my wall.
I did that on purpose. I went into your yoga buddies.
I know.
I saw it. And, you know, it's about one girl just had yoga that day, and you guys are all massaging her to do this or do Bikram yoga. And I said, I'm going to come in there like a hell's angel. They fuck you, fuck me, or something. And
you were like, I'm going to fuck everything that moves for 5 days and have the best smelling jism you ever smelled.
And so it stayed there for like 12 hours. Okay, these women are cool, but by the next day, it was fucking deleted.
No, it's not deleted. It just got rolled up into the other comments. Because I actually, that is my most conservative friend that I have in the world. She was totally fine with it. She thought it was hysterical. We talked about it. It's just rolled up with some other comments.
Oh, I couldn't find it. And I thought it was deleted. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that you guys took it.
No, she thought you were adorable. And I sent her the picture of you with no shirt on.
Oh, the nice one where I'm supposedly in the bathtub.
The nice one, yeah. So we were talking about you, so that was really cute.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad she took it because it was a total prank, or that was my humor.
It was precious. Thank you for that.
So when you first saw it, did you fall over laughing?
Yes, I did. And I was like, I'm going to warn her, but I'm not saying, I'm going to be like, you might be offended, but this is my friend, Bob, and it's hysterical. And she was like, oh, my God, it is hysterical. But I don't understand it. So I told her about Bob Fest.
Yes, and that it was a promo. I found the right place to market myself. A nano community. I said, this is where I will do my marketing campaign, among the yogis.
Well, I'm so glad that it was intentional because I thought for a second that you were on the wrong thread and were going to post it on the thread while I was announcing that I was going to be on here, but it's even cuter that you knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
Because for anyone who's listening, this was a long thread. This is like 10 middle-aged women that I all know from high school going on and on and on about yoga and this and that, and then right in the middle of it, Bob chimes in.
I'm going to fuck anything that moves for the next 5 days, and my jism spurts will be really smelly, wonderfully smelly. It was actually a disgusting statement.
Oh, it was adorable.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we talk more about? Should I tell you something else that I looked at?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I looked at the Gutenberg Galaxy. I'll tell you, I also looked at. Cliche to archetype, but that was too much. Like, I got the book out of the library. I couldn't even. I looked at it, and I was like, fuck this. It's too hard.
Yeah. That's right. And then, you know why? That book is McLuhan's. He calls that his best book. It goes past understanding media. It squares understanding media. And Ion showed its awareness. I played it a few months ago. Ion found an old session, and he says, well, it's in Marshall's autobiography. And I said, he never wrote an autobiography. And then Marshall says, no, he did. And then we work. I said, understanding media? No. Then I go from cliche to archetype. He goes, that's it. And it's a secret that that's his autobiography. Only I almost is the only few people who know it. And I'd forgotten it at the beginning. But once when we got there, and he said, that was the one, I said, bingo, that is his autobiography. And that's I knew it. Or he knew how to absorb from his ESP. He knew I knew that, and so he replayed me back to me. And that's how fucking accurate or perceptive Ion is. He really made an amazing McLuhan statement, and he had it right. So, cliché archetype is McLuhan's autobiography. He became a cliché, and then he became an archetype, you know, his media image.
Well, and that's the other thing. The whole time I've been looking at all this material, I just keep thinking, imagine what it would have been like to be listening in the 80s. Like, because now we can get it, but like, back then.
Not the 80s. He died in 1980. Imagine listening in the 50s and 60s.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
No, there was an article written on him in the early 60s. You know, he was a local phenomenon in the college, university in Toronto, but this journalist says, nobody knows what McLuhan means other than himself and maybe God. I mean, he was seen as totally incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, because everybody was looking at content. And Stu Bone used to go to the McLuhan lectures, and it wasn't until like 10, 15 years later. She says, holy shit, I always thought when he was talking about TV, he was talking about TV shows, the content. He did not hear that he's talking about the tactile mesh as opposed to the flat page, the forms. And she's a good example of just the average person's bright person who could not, who just took, like you said, a limited meaning of media.
Mm-hmm. But then I also looked at the medium as the massage.
Yes, that's good.
And I just fell in love with this little book.
Yeah.
This book was so fun to read. I got up on the part that you needed to hold up to a mirror and held it up to a mirror. I just think this, I mean, I don't know. It's so groovy, too. You know, it's so old, but the pictures are really cool.
It's a revolutionary graphic. There's a book
really
written
was.
On that book now about the graphic revolution that book brought in.
Mm-hmm.
It was reviewed by Time Magazine called the non-book. Everybody was amazed at this writer who wrote a big, long book on social media. Now he's putting this collage stuff. It was shocking to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't actually even like it. You know, professors would say in 68, 69, after that little book came out, well, we've read your book. Oh, what book's that? The Medium is a Massage. And he'd go, that's not a book. That's just a smattering of quotations. And they'd be freaked that the book that made him famous, Marshall didn't even care about. It was done by graphic designers in New York City. They also
it's
made
really
an album.
Effective, though.
Yes, it was effective. But McLuhan wasn't into being effective and popular. It matched people's late 60s mixed media sensibility that was just starting to happen. The collage effect for the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was popular. And the kids were tired of being in school reading books. This was an easy book to read and neat pictures and neat ideas. But it's McLuhan's vision was way beyond being popular. You know what I mean? He wanted to turn off TV for 6 months, orchestrate the whole globe, which no one knew had a clue. And I've tracked him all these years and watched people, you know, mea culpa 30 years later. Holy shit. A famous one is Lewis Lapham, the editor of Atlantic Monthly. By the mid-90s, the world doesn't make any sense to him anymore. So he starts reading McLuhan, who he put down in the 60s. He says, holy shit, McLuhan's right. And so when MIT republished Understanding Media in 94, he wrote the foreword saying, wow, we were all stupid. That's New York intellectuals. We had no clue how right this guy was.
So
it's a fascinating story. It's like watching the RNA drops and watch the disbelief and the incredible effects and nobody knows it and all that. That's the way McLuhan was. He was a phenomenon to watch, and it showed the blind spots in culture.
Then the other thing that I did, like, read all the way through actually twice, and what I found the most helpful in my literature survey was the Playboy interview.
Yes, yeah. And you know, here's the story about that.
Yeah.
It's you can't imagine anybody talking like that. And that's what happened. Eric Norden interviewed McLuhan and could not understand McLuhan. So he asked McLuhan to write out his answers. So McLuhan wrote out those answers so the guy could understand them.
Oh, so when he says we talked into the night in front of the crackling fire, that's a bunch of bullshit?
Well, that's the first time. He doesn't say that when he went home and transcribed it, it didn't make any sense. He didn't know how to do it. So he probably had a rough sketch of the stuff, and he asked McLuhan to fill it out and explain yourself. And so it becomes a good interview because he's forced to do a lot of explaining for a guy who go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's good. It's a good, you know, it's broken the questions. Help you break it down so you can kind of get a feel for what you're going to be looking at next.
It's spelled out linearly. It's very, very
it
useful. Yeah.
It's very useful. And then when I wrote my little novel there, I read the Playboy interview with Nabokov.
Yeah.
For that, because my characters read the book Lolita. These Playboy interviews are just fantastic. Now, when I was a little girl, I can remember adults would joke and say, yeah, we get Playboy for the articles, and
right.
I believe them now. I mean, they are just fantastic.
That's right. They take all the major culture phenomena and interview everybody. There's collections you can get of Playboy interviews. They're all, it was the major forum, and McLuhan used to write about the figure effect of the Playboy interview and why it was popular.
What did he say about that?
The dialogue is the new form of interaction. You read an article by somebody, you watch the interface between the figure, the celebrity, and the Playboy interviewer. So this, the talk show, the going back and forth, it's a bit more oral. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's oral.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the retrieved bias in a tactile environment. Oral culture comes back. The Playboy interview was oral, but it satisfied the literate highbrows because it was about intellectual, literate topics.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a mixture of eye and ear.
Okay.
And so it became, you made it in the 60s when you were given the Playboy interview.
I bet.
Yep. And for literate ideas, for linear ideas, it's the best interesting thing because people are forced to explain themselves. That's a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than just write an article and try to read what the guy's saying, he's forced to answer questions about what he wrote.
Mm-hmm. I did have a question of something that I didn't understand in this article. Maybe I could ask you that.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're talking about, the numbing effect that we talked about a little while ago.
That's where you got the numbing effect idea. That's probably spelled out in the Playboy interview, right?
It is, but the part that I don't understand is it talks about you're not only being a numbing effect because of the imbalance of the sense ratios, but because there is a psychic pain. And I think it has to do with this identity thing. I don't know, but can you tell me what that is? Because I would like to understand that better. Like, what's the pain that the numbing effect is trying to numb us from? In addition to the imbalance of the sense ratio, or maybe because of?
When you get a wound on your arm, there's numbness. And then there's beginning of the pain. So there's alarm, and then there's resistance. There's actually four phases: numbness, alarm, resistance. So when a new technology comes in, TV is going to wipe out the literate dominance. It's a way better medium. It's got more sensory involvement than the flat page. So it's a knockout blow to the collective sensibility and ratios of a literate society. So there's huge numbness, and then alarm and resistance and panic. And it usually leads to war, okay? Because people, when they are shocked into a new image, a new effect, they try to retrieve the old image, and that's violent, or they try to forge a new image that relates to the new effect, and that's violent. So there's nothing but violence as people try to retrieve the old identity or forge a new one. And they're just trying to tune in to the changing in the sensory ratios. And they don't know that the media is doing that. That's the numbness. So they get the wound and they get numb. And then they just notice the bleeding and the cut and the pain. They don't notice.
Now, explain to me right at this point where this narcissist thingy fits in with this. You know how a narcissist wasn't in love with it?
He was numbed by his extension.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. He was numb. All right. Okay.
So when you extend the eye, you numb the eye loses its own viability and now is dependent on the book, which is an extension of the eye. So the numbing process is what happens when you replace your senses with a machine. The book is a machine, right? So when the technology replaces the action of your eyes, that numbs the collectivity. Now you have to remember, it's hard to measure it on each individual. But you have to look at this as across the board, a society that just speaks and talks, all of a sudden they're reading. When everybody in society is reading, that has a weird 100th monkey effect.
Right.
So there's this numbing happening in the nebulous meme level. And that's why people would try to, and one scientist measured the effect of TV versus the newspaper for General Electric and found that, yes, TV made different brain waves than the newspaper. So he said McLuhan was right. So that was
But newspaper is different than book, too.
Right. But this guy took TV and newspaper, and he said, yes, the brain would respond. It was changed by the TV as opposed to the effect of the newspaper. So he tells McLuhan, New York Times write an article on it, and they call him up, and And they asked McClellan, isn't he all happy to validate it? He says, no, that's all well and good, but I'm interested in more discoveries. So he didn't even, like, turn it into a point of view that he was trying to validate something. He knew he was right, and he knew that the scientific analysis of this effect on the brain was just one limited chemical body analysis of the effects. He was also talking about the nebulous across the board meme effects, which are really hard to see. So usually you will see retrieval of sports or retrieval of art, all these phenomena across the culture, like all the events of the 60s, you know, starting with the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Kennedy assassination, and then everybody, all the prime ministers going to the for the Kennedy assassination funeral, and then you have the LSD, and then you have the sex revolution, and you have the hippies, and you have the middle class, all the, and Civil War, and Iran, I mean Vietnam, all that stuff across the board is caused by the satellite having instant transmission through TV. So here's this new event. Everybody's running around the 60s, and they ask McClellan, well, what's causing this? And he says, the invisible environment, the satellite. No one was watching the satellites being built up around the planet. They were watching TV, and they were watching the revolutions on TV, all the different fads, like from the Beatles to San Francisco music. And nobody knew that that was television in a panic state responding to the new hidden environment of the computers and the satellite. So television went through identity crisis, and of course people were inside that and thought they were having an identity crisis, and then started running around and being nutty and having trying to retrieve. The right wing tries to retrieve the past, and the left wing tries to go forward into a new collectivity. The right wing, they try to retrieve the individualist, literate, hard-boiled, do-it-on-your-own, and the emotion of multitude that that the left represents is what TV favors. So you have the TV, as in the 60s, you have the left being popular, and the right doing a rear-guard action, and they lose. The left takes over. But there are other technological factors happening that made the left even do lousy. So then when you get to the digital era, that's when the individual, the virtual individual is retrieved, and that's Reaganism and neoconservatism. So the conservatives finally got the right-wing ideology applied to a virtual reality matrix of the Reagan world, where the president is a simulated actor, and that rode its fad for 10 years, and that collapsed once you got into the digital, the web. Then the web caused an identity crisis in all the old media environments themselves. So you can map it through.
The identity crisis thing might not be just literal, but, you know, I think about Facebook a lot because I'm on it a lot. And Michael's book has some interesting things to say about that. And when you talk about creating these images, I guess I wonder how that, like, that's a huge extension outside yourself to be able to create this whole person that might be like nothing like you in real life. I think
that's a god. That's your creating. You're taking the analog media, movies, TV, radio, newspapers, book pages, speech, the whole collage of media that evolved up to the satellite, and then it's absorbed into this little spaceship, rocket ship called your little laptop or iPhone, and you have all that history of thousands of years of media right there, all happening at the same time, and you can edit it and project it. You are actually at the God level of controlling your own reality that Ion talks about.
It's so fun.
Right, and yet you got billions of other people doing it. So everybody's canceled by everybody else, but nobody can. It's a novelty, and nobody, the people are numb by it. They love the extension, and they'll do it regardless. They can't stop.
And that's when, like, we're required to feed it.
Yes.
That's what the relationship is at that point, right?
That's your chip body. You now, what was the computer landscape that you'd see in the banks in the 60s, 70s were real, these reels of tapes, you know, that old big mainframe computers. But by 20, 30 years later, when you have all that computer shrunk to a little iPhone, that is the landscape becoming a barnacle or a body attached to you, and you must serve that body. just mm-hmm. like you serve your chemical body. You must feed it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So Web 2.0 shrinks the computer landscape and creates the five-body circus.
Okay.
You've got to raise your daughters. You got to control their internet bullshit. You got to get them to school to do the literacy. You're a fascist. Take literacy. You're a fascist of literacy, and you're a a monarchist of Facebookness, and then you're an anarchist as you make new imagery every day, upsetting all your friends' lives with new fucking shit you're putting out and going into their computer.
Right. Well, and then the other thing that I noticed, too, is when I look back at the medium is the massage book, like the photography is intriguing and things
yeah.
like that, but it's not very sophisticated. And, like, when it's showing the foot and the wheel in photographs.
You know what that is? That
what?
Is photographed by one of the main artists in the Fluxus art movement, which Yoko Ono was part of in New York City in the early 60s. The Fluxus
That's
art movement.
So cool.
Yeah, do you know about Fluxus? You ever heard of it?
No, but I know that Yoko Ono was cool.
Right. So Yoko was part of the avant-garde, the other art movement beside pop art and Warhol and those guys, was Fluxus,
okay.
where a bunch of these artists who moved to Soho and took over the abandoned buildings down there, and they went on to become the top artists of the 80s and 90s and are hugely, you know, successful. Their art is historically relevant because they made art, they took data further, and they made little toys and things, and they kept the art myth going. But the photographer was Peter Cooper, I think his name is. He was a Fluxus photographer, and they made he made a movie with these big images of the foot and all that. So it's just stills from a book, from a movie made by a Fluxus filmmaker. Right in the middle of the book, you see the young woman spreading her arms out and she has no clothes on?
Yeah, yeah, for clothing and skin, yeah.
Right. Now, you know who that is?
Who is it?
That is Marshall McLuhan's daughter, Mary McLuhan. She was hanging out with the artist. She got the photographer, Fluxus guy, to take a picture and put it in the book, and Marshall ostensibly never recognized it because the crease of the middle goes over Mary's face.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a joke Mary did on her father.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And, you know, when I tell feminists that, they love Mary for doing that. You know, the feminists.
I'm thinking the same thing.
Right. Stick it to your father.
Yeah.
And but you have to know Mary, and you have to know what she looks like, and look very closely at the split image to see it is Mary.
Very cool. So the what I was thinking is, and when I look at one of the reasons I delighted in this book so much and laid in bed and read it, and it was rainy outside and just was such a fun evening, because I'm so nostalgic for this time in history, and everything is so slick now. We don't see a picture of, like, someone's dry toe with their...
No, you've got several levels of virtual reality happening. It's the machines, mm-hmm. extending machines. There's no, you're nostalgic for the last time the chemical body had an interesting mixed media environment. That's the 60s. After
mm-hmm.
that becomes programmed.
It's all fake now.
Well, it's several levels of fake. The android meme keeps, it has nothing to do with you in the chemical body. It's the android meme extending itself, then squaring itself, and then squaring itself again. So there's several levels of simulation, and the average chemical body eyeball or perception apparatus will think it's phony because there's so many levels of abstraction, you could say, tactile abstraction. So, yes, it has nothing to do with you. Everybody's disappeared.
Has something happened to the eye, though?
Yes, yes.
Where it craves prettier and prettier images, like more and more refined
yeah.
sugar? Like, is that what's going on?
Yeah, and it's like the young girls growing up, their chemical bodies, they're trained literacy to think they have a chemical body, yet they can't stop it being part of the TV body. So the 80s girls and the 90s girls and the present girls, they all have to be in the media.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what's real. It becomes the cliche, discarnate, electrified body becomes an archetype. It becomes more real than the chemical body, and it's happened more extreme with each generation from the 70s. Mm-hmm. So an older person like yourself, you're not living in the fourth degree of squared virtual perception, and it just looks odd to you because you've got mutant eyes that are enjoying it mm-hmm. compared to your eyes.
Yeah. And then I'm just going to go ahead and talk about books a little bit. Like, we can go back and forth on the McLuhan stuff, but, like, you know, he was an English teacher.
Yeah.
And said straight up on the CBS interview, I don't want to get rid of books. I teach books all day, every day.
That's why he said he knew that literacy was going to be disappeared, and he got that from Wyndham Lewis. And he said the only way we can preserve literate religion, like he was a devout Catholic, and the book world and the university world is to turn television off. And nobody did it, and he saw it all disappear, and he knew that.
Okay,
his key student, Don Thiel, who I knew, who writes the best book of McLuhan, he said it was fun being a professor in the 40s and 50s and 60s, 50s and 60s, but he said he would never be a professor starting from the 90s if he was young, starting over again, because it was no longer a chemical body learning environment. It was totally obsolete. The universities are so obsolete, it's ridiculous. It's as bad as the hospitals. And Marshall's top student understood that, and he became president of a university in the 80s. Yet he knew it was all over. And so Don is the voice of McLuhan after McLuhan died about the McLuhan's attempt to save civilization did not happen. It was not successful. And so McLuhan had to adapt to the new, and he did a pretty good job of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say... if we say books are going to go away, I guess I wonder what that whole... What about digital? Like, what about just not printing books anymore? People still want to read. Isn't part of this, like, knowing that it's going on and taking what's best out of the technology, I mean, just because it...
Well, the rule is... Well, the rule, what McLuhan would say in the 50s and 60s, that the book is obsolete, but when something's obsolete, you get more and more of them because they don't have any impact on shaping society anymore. But they're a good leisure activity. So you get more and more.
Okay.
More obsolete means more and more, which is, again, McLuhan playing word games and people not looking into what he actually said. Just take
all
obsolete.
I didn't know that. I thought it meant that it was going away.
Right. See, you have a traditional meaning. And McLuhan is still a literate artist. He's a literate artist upsetting your cliches that you think you know. The artist always does that. So he, on a sub-level, he was saying words backwards from what people usually meant. So the book was obsolete, and he said, we get more and more of them, but they'll be used for new purposes. And so books spread all over society for all kinds of things. One of the most popular kind of book is the listing of things.
Mm-hmm.
Or the self-help, psychology and sociology, which becomes self-help stuff. That's the big book market. Mm-hmm. That's the Oprah Winfrey mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. That is not a novel. That's Hillary talking about their heart and their private literate identity and trying to save it among the whack job world of Madonna and Bob, you know?
And I got to remember while I say this because I'll forget. That was another thing that I was thinking when I was looking at this is, like, the secret, which this is probably somewhere and I missed it. It's no, like, super clever insight. But, like, that whole secret thing is based on a vision board. Like, it's
the eyeball.
Vision thing. Yeah.
Save the eyeball. Save the literate eye.
Yeah, that's why it doesn't work.
You know what it is? It's saving that abstract effect in the mind. See, why did the Catholic religion, you know, for 1,000 years, emphasize the afterlife? They emphasized the afterlife because that was the abstract space that the alphabet was creating. And Augustine mm-hmm. came, like in the Greek eye, the balanced world of Greece, of eye and ear, mm-hmm. they never could resolve questions. And as the new literate environment was affecting them, they thought they had to resolve it. Oral people don't have to resolve it, but literate people do. So these thinkers, starting to write down stuff, but with basic oral nature, were trying to come to a conclusion. And they could not resolve it. It's called, in the Hellenic culture, you know, Greece, Rome period, up to Christ and that, and after Christ, that Hellenic culture could not resolve the opposites, which had been made starkly opposite and separate by the alphabet. It got resolved by Augustine. What he did is he created a third level. He created the idea of an individual soul that resolved the argument between the eye and the ear, and he was actually just consolidating visual space and abstract visual space as the psyche in the Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So that self was solidified even more by the printing press and then dissolves in the 20th century with electricity. It just destroys that third space, and that's where people fall back into paganism and drug-taking and alcoholism and just being a robot of their senses because they've lost the sacred visual billiard ball that was created by the phonetic alphabet in the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
So the theology of St. Augustine held it together for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He conceptualized. So I'm saying, so then in the 70s, the baby boomers want to retrieve that billiard ball of visual space, but it's too far gone, so they turn it into an acoustic vision of melting away your ego, melting away your literate billiard ball, and merging with some abstract divinity, which is still based on the abstract effect, and that's Gnosticism. That is saying, I'm not interested in the world. The world's fallen. I want to go to an abstract space. And yet it's not an abstract identity like St. Augustine said. It's an experience. It's a drug experience. It's an isolated spiritual experience that is a sacred because it reinforces the sense that you're unique.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole counterculture, you know, from Leary to Marion Williamson, is an attempt to save the visual space billiard ball that Augustine laid out, but it can't be a hard, solid, separate billiard ball. It has to be a melting billiard ball.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, you did talk to Hillary about Marion Williamson. I worked for her 10
what
years
period?
Ago when she was in Detroit at the Church of Today, and I was living over there. I worked for her. First, I worked at the church as a writer and did, like, the programs and stuff like that, because so many speakers came through, we had to have a lot of marketing posters.
Is this after she freaked out in early 90s? When is this?
It was 2000.
Yeah, that's after she... Remember, she ran for politics a few years before and was disgusted?
Well, she did the Global Renaissance Alliance, but I didn't know that she ran for politics, if she did.
Yeah, she was talking about it, and it was so vicious that she retreated very quickly and got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
then she went like Ginny. She went local and formed a local church.
Well, it was a church that was already formed.
Yeah, but she entered the space.
She entered the space because the Course in Miracles was kind of a text that was popularized at that time. And Oprah did the coffee shop for this church where I worked, and Marianne came in and was the spiritual leader. So in addition to wanting to have a career in politics, she's also wanted to have a conventional career as a spiritual leader of a large church with a televised broadcast, fantastic praise band, and, like, huge congregation. Like the
parking lot propping up her mouth, propping up the verbal logocentric discourse of the literate space.
Right. Right.
And you have women taking it over. Men can't take it anymore. So women took it over, and from Gloria Steinem up to Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
They took over the male logocentric statement.
Mm-hmm.
And got mowed down ridiculously, every one of them, because that was so rearview mirror. It was visual space fundamentalism by educated women. They weren't going to go for the simple Bible, but they actually were responding, trying to preserve the same visual space.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And there's variations of it. Different personalities go into different, like there's the sheltered women, kind of women that go and help to beat up women. And then there's the, which is just the rage of the male, hysterical male reacting to the left, right hemisphere feminist thing taking over, women being better in the electric environment. Men get pissed off, so they beat up their women, right?
Right.
That's a effect of the TV satellite mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you have all this range of women taking over the roles of industrial life, the patriarchal world, which is what Hillary was saying. Hillary's going on about, we discovered we became men. No, you didn't become men. You became literate entities, extensions of mobilizing the literate environment that is the sacred space of America.
Mm-hmm.
So you mix in your biological form in the middle of that. You get all mixed up. You start thinking, oh, a man's a man, a woman's a woman, and that's what needs to be integrated or stood up against, and you're missing that. No, you are in your biological form, which is your physical being and your godhood.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the issue. You are working for the meme of visual space and protected against the tactile situation that Madonna and subsequent little kids have taken over, and now you're dealing with Miley Cyrus being a fucking porn star right there in front of your 12-year-old.
Right. Well, and being really normal, I'm a normal woman who grew up, I can tell you that I have had, I think many women that you, like you just described, share this experience, because my girlfriends do, have had like some major father issues to figure out.
Yeah.
And also have gone through a period of time where I've used physical culture in an extreme way to do like muscle
to save a chemical literate body.
Right, P90X or Bikram yoga.
The literate body starts to have muscles. And the kinetic space comes in with industry. And so you have these girls, aerobics, running fanatically with literate visual and kinetic things. Now, another point, you just said father issues. Here's the father issue. And McLuhan brilliantly, read Mechanical Bride. That's a really good book, 1951. And he writes about Dagwood and Blondie. The father is neutered in the American culture after World War II. So you have women who see their father, and they're not inside the patriarchal hypnosis and numbness of visual space. The father is weak now. The mother is going to dominate. But because of the daughter is literate and has a bias toward the left hemisphere nostalgically, wants to respect the father, but the father can't be the patriarch anymore, so the daughter becomes the patriarch. And it's filled with all kinds of confusions.
Oh, my God, that is so it.
That's right.
That is it.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Yeah. You take that excerpt. Where are we? What fucking day are we in? You take that little bit and send it around, make a clip, and send it to your friends, all of your friends, the whole fucking generation.
That's what it is. And when you say it like that, it's so simple.
It's so perfect because I'm not talking on political, personal point of view levels. I'm talking technically. Technically.
Right, this is just what happens in a literate society.
Right.
So calm down. It's not even a big fucking deal. As long as you're aware of it, then you can deal with it.
Yes, and now society, if they get even more aware, they could have 50 years ago said, okay, we better turn off TV for 6 months so we get what the fuck is this going to do. But humans, they love the contrast and they're not going to do it. But if you're going to state an ideal, that's the political thing to say, not all the other content issues. So if you get to understand this, what I just said, you'll relax, you'll understand what you're doing, and you'll probably be a little more happier of why your family's going to be wiped out. They said the pain in the concentration camps of the Jews, the real pain was they didn't know why that was happening. You know? It's not having a reason which drives the literate Western mind up the wall. So you have this thing that I just spelled out. It explains to them, so at least they go to the slaughter understanding, having a pretty good reason why. It's a bit too late to stop the media environment because it's now the machines extending the machines. We're not even involved anymore. And that's where iron comes in with the RNA drops. You need something powerful like the RNA drops just to handle your understanding of what's happening.
Right.
So for the part of your mind that needs a reason, I'm given the best reason. So that you can understand how it got this far.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's real good ideas, and people like good, solid, quote, truths or ideas that are not mixed up with the old cliche bullshit. And so that's why we say we're talking technically. We're actually stating scientifically obvious perceptual information. Once it's said to you, it's obvious.
The other thing that's really interesting, too, is that now we're talking about all this McLuhan stuff, and we're not really talking about ION right now.
Yes.
And then, you know, I had immersed myself in a bunch of ION stuff, and then really only knew that side of you, and then just the fun, nutty side of you that would, like, leave that comment on my Facebook.
Right.
And now to look at this intellectual side, I mean, it's staggering the amount
right.
of legitimacy that it then turns around and, like, if anyone would ever doubt ION or need to, you know, we've not known what's gone on in Duke's fighting and blah, blah, blah. Like, look at the intellectual stuff and see, like, where this came from, because
right.
it's so legit.
That's right. Have you ever heard Rogue ION, where he did a couple of YouTubes, and the first one featured a couple hours of McLuhan. At the end of it, he says, this show is called Moi, French for me, but he says it's McLuhan on ION, the last chemical body voice that could say technically what ION was up against, the Android meme, was said by McLuhan, and that's why ION presented McLuhan as the last human chemical body voice.
So ION is the antidote to the problem.
To a post-McLuhan, post-Croker, post-Thompson, post-LaRouche, post-everything
world. So we're all, like, fucked up by the media, but ION is the answer to that.
Right, because the Book of Revelation predicts the mark of the beast, the matrix, everybody has the mark of the beast, and they live in a virtual economy, and if you don't have the mark, then you're not allowed in. It's just like in the 70s, you had to have a credit card. So that is the prison we've been in for a couple of decades, and that's right. never going to get changed unless something that is more powerful than that goes around it right. and counters the Android meme. And that's what ION is, and so you could call ION the Second Coming. It's a breakthrough from the inevitable tyranny that the prophets knew would happen, because technology would go to the virtual society we have today. Mm-hmm. You couldn't stop it.
And now I can see that. So
yeah,
I mean, thank you so much for inspiring me.
Staying alive, for staying alive, mastering it, and patiently waiting for the Hillarys to come through,
exactly,
and being quiet and being nice to her, and she never got it, but maybe she will later.
What did you just say?
I said being patient and quiet and listening to the Hillarys rage through, and then they don't get it, but maybe she will later.
No, see, I think she... I mean, I don't know if I want to say she will or she won't, but I really liked her a lot, and I thought that she could come on here and talk to you like she did for the very first time for 2 hours, especially since I've, like, called up and fallen asleep for a year.
Wait, what? Who fell asleep?
I remember I always used to call in and I'd fall asleep.
Right.
I've been doing this for 7 months, and this is the first time I've ever, like, talked to you about anything. Yeah, or talk about anything other than, like, giggle and talk about the drops and stuff like that.
Right. This is irrelevant stuff. Tracy was waiting for, but it didn't happen enough. She just found it too silly what was going on. But she could have did what you did and read McLuhan. So that's why ION tells the rewriters, after they feel they've understood ION, they say, what do we do next? And he says, study Bob. That means go into this McLuhan stuff and find out your natural inclination and your 6 degree separation to figure out how this happened. Well, we've got the right people. McLuhan is one of the main ones to understand how we got here. So you like Hillary. What was I going to say about that? So,
and I did contact her right after the show and told her I'd listen, because she was on Facebook, and I told her that ION had called in. She wanted to call in, and she said she really had had enough. I think she's going to look at it. Like, I think she just... She came as a guest on the show. How is she supposed to know at all?
They don't know where they are. They don't know. That's what I'm going to say.
Find out, you're kind of embarrassed. Like, I was kind of embarrassed. You know, a legend had said to me when I posted on Dupes, oh, I found a YouTube channel that plays all the Marshall McLuhan videos one after the other. And legend was like, well, we have McLuhan on Maui. And then I looked at it, and I'm like, I am so embarrassed.
Yeah. Right.
You know, you're just like, but you can't be embarrassed. You just have to get on the phone and be like, okay, well, here I am today, because you can't miss out.
Yeah, your chemical body's embarrassed because you think there's a bunch. Do you think there's a chemical body community that you're responsible to, and there you're going to lose face? You don't know there's been no community for 50 fucking years in actual living lifestyle.
Right.
And you are walking around rearview images inculcated by your education, and all you have to do is recognize, oh, nobody knows I'm embarrassed. Nobody cares. They're all too embarrassed themselves. And then you can just walk in. Nobody holds it against you.
But the embarrassment is an initiation, so you kind of want to tell so that everybody knows where you are now, too.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it was neat.
Okay,
it was
so
neat.
I want to
talk... Wait. You said it was neat?
Yeah, it was neat. You know,
it was
like
neat
I thought
you,
I loved...
that you overcame your embarrassment. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, I thought I loved you before, and now I'm just like, oh my God, that man is brilliant.
Yeah.
And you know, somebody was saying that. I think even Hillary was saying that, like, flattery like that is a chip body program.
Right.
That you would run where you would kiss ass. Like, I am not kissing your ass.
No. You're delighted with the actual bona fide
I'm
discovery.
Floored. When I listened to Sue and Jenny, I was floored. I mean, there are some smart
right.
fucking ass people around here. Bart, oh, my God. Oh, my
yeah.
God. It's
yeah.
amazing.
Are you talking about Jeannie and Sue on McLuhan and Maui? Is that where you heard them?
Yes, because
yeah.
I listened
yeah.
to Jeannie. Yeah. And,
yeah.
Okay, so can we switch to the next thing I kind of want to talk about?
Yeah, just before we do that, just the Hillary thing is Hillary has a strong identity because she has a gig and gets paying for it. Unfortunately, those people are going to find the hardest to accept the embarrassment because, you know, you're anonymous. You're not a somebody who has a fucking working audience like she has. It's lucky
no.
when I show up that you're a fucking nobody because then you can handle the embarrassment. There's not one
right.
media person that can take it. They reject it.
Right.
Because they can't handle the embarrassment. They've unfortunately
right.
established a media productivity in an archive that is totally obsolete and ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. Well, you do the embarrassing in a good way too. So.
Yes, I wait around because I'm not. I'm like Ion. I don't care if you get embarrassed. It's fucking temporary. It's just an emotion.
Right.
I'm here to see if you can actually get what really is amazingly to get. I mean, I had to put up
yes.
with Carolyn for fucking 30 fucking. I don't think Carolyn ever got it or sort of got it, but we don't know. See, if pressed, if she was in a fucking, if I took over and everybody had to be in a McLuhan camp, she'd do well at it because she'd remember all the stuff she heard, but she doesn't use it because she has her own identity. She's a media victim. She has a role, an important role in medicine, and lucky she got the golden role of bringing forth the new medicine. So we let her, okay, you don't have to know McLuhan. You actually are bringing
right.
the antidote to McLuhan. So there's the joke about Carolyn.